This is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to episode 20. Kaushik, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Episode 20, wow. We made it through 20 episodes, man.
Yeah, I know. We originally started off saying that we were going to try to make it to 10, and then we decided to keep going. Now we're at 20, so it feels like we're on a roll. I'm stoked to keep going.
Yeah, sounds good.
So, what are we talking about today?
Today is actually going to be an extremely interesting episode because we have this fine gentleman with us today, all the way from the IDE that both you and I swear by and we believe is possibly the best IDE that we've used.
I felt this way about the tooling that this company's provided for over a decade now.
We have done a full episode devoted just to Android Studio, and we talked a lot about IntelliJ. Today, we are extremely pleased and grateful that we have Hadi with us today. Hadi Hariri, welcome to the show, Hadi.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be on.
Hadi has a couple of amazing videos, and I'll make sure to add all of those in the show notes. In a previous episode in which Jake Wharton was on, he mentioned one video that I hadn't seen before, and this is Hadi basically giving some quick tips on IntelliJ. So those are, I'll add a link to all of those videos. That's the first time I came across Hadi. Hadi also has a very interesting Twitter account. So for those of you who don't already follow Hadi, make sure you follow Hadi.
Definitely. Hey, Hadi, can you give us a little bit background on kind of who you are so the listeners can get a little more up close and personal with you and kind of your background and where you are now?
So I've been in software development for about 25, 30 years, which kind of shows my age. Like many, I started as a hobby back with the Amstrad CPC. I don't know if you remember that machine.
Wow.
The one with the colored buttons. That was, long time ago. And then I professionally, I started to do DBase, Paradox, Clipper. Then I went into the Delphi space for a few years. And then from there, I kind of jumped over to .NET. And I was doing .NET for many years. And then a few years ago, I kind of got more into the JVM space, and primarily because of Kotlin, which was our language. I mean, for me, I kind of always stayed away, and no, not to offend anyone, but I always kind of stayed away from the JVM because Java wasn't that much to my liking as a language. But Kotlin being quite similar to C# and JavaScript, it started to attract me. And I've been doing, I've done from web development, server side, client side, rich client applications, working most of my life. I've either been working as a consultant or working for tooling companies. So tools are something I love, I guess.
I think we should have asked the question, is there any programming language that you haven't worked with that would have been
Oh, yeah, there's many. Oh, yeah. PHP. And I hope I won't have to.
What? PHP? Oh, my God. You're missing out a lot on the hot stuff.
It's funny that you bring that up because I have a lot of companies that I work with that ask me as soon as I walk in the door, hey, Don, do you know any good PHP developers? And it's impossible to find great PHP developers. They're either taken or they're just impossible to find in general. So Hadi, I remember communicating with you as close to a decade ago when you were working in .NET, and I was also working in .NET. And ReSharper was the tool that was kind of the big thing back then. It was the plugin for Visual Studio that a company called JetBrains created. And you work for JetBrains, is that correct?
Yeah, I've been at JetBrains now. I think it's coming up to my 6th year. Yeah, in January will be my 6th year.
Oh, wow.
So I started, I was kind of like the first technical evangelist / developer advocate for JetBrains back when I started in 2010. And I actually came on board for .NET. So I was kind of like the ReSharper, .Trace and .NET tools evangelist. And as I said, over the past few years, I kind of moved more into the JVM space. So, yeah, but it's been nearly 6 years now. Long time.
That's excellent. And so just again, if a lot of people are not, it's amazing actually that I'm going to say this, but a lot of people are not familiar with what JetBrains is or what JetBrains does or even the products that JetBrains creates. Can you give us a little bit of rundown on that so people can kind of get some background on it so when we move forward, they're more familiar?
Yeah, sure. So JetBrains actually started many years ago, 16 years ago, with a single product, which was called back then Renamer. And all it did was rename classes. And it was a plugin for, one of them was a plugin for JBuilder at the time. And eventually that evolved into what's called IntelliJ. And IntelliJ is our kind of like the Java IDE that we have. And then gradually, after IntelliJ, ReSharper came about, which is a Visual Studio plugin, which kind of simulates some of the aspects that IntelliJ has, but inside Visual Studio. So it gives you better navigation and refactoring, code analysis, inspections. So some of the things that people, if they're not familiar with IntelliJ, also provide, like, you know, IntelliJ has something like 2,000-3,000 inspections that take a look at your code and tell you potential issues that you have in addition to refactoring and everything else. So we started to have those two tools. And then gradually, out of our need, we started to develop other tools such as like TeamCity, which are a continuous integration server, UTrack for issue tracking and defect management. And then we started to spin off into smaller IDEs. So like WebStorm, PyCharm, RubyMine, all of these are kind of like the smaller IDEs that we provide, which are all built on the IntelliJ platform, which is open source, by the way. So IntelliJ has the IntelliJ IDEA Ultimate, and then it's got the free open source platform, which is IntelliJ Platform. So we're like completely focused around developer tools. I mean, like that's our main area, just developer tools.
Excellent. Now you brought up the word IDEA and the platform, and you're kind of talking about that. From my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, IDEA is basically an IDE platform that you can build other IDEs on. For example, all of my favorite IDEs are IDEA based. And again, please correct me if that's incorrect statement, such as I like to use Android Studio for JavaScript. I use WebStorm for Ruby. I use RubyMine and Python. I use PyCharm. Is that a correct statement? And what is exactly the IDEA platform and so forth?
Yeah, so there's two things. There's IntelliJ IDEA, which is the actual IDE. That's the Java and the Polyglot IDE. And then that is built on what we call the IntelliJ platform. And then we have the IntelliJ IDEA Community Edition, which is a cut-down kind of version, open source. But they're both on top of this IntelliJ platform. So the platform is called IntelliJ. And then WebStorm, PyCharm, all of these are added functionality built on this IntelliJ platform. But at the same time, IntelliJ IDEA, being polyglot, basically has all the functionality all of the smaller IDEs have, except for a couple. One of them is C-Line, which is our C++ IDE, and AppCode, which is the iOS development environment. They basically share the same functionality. The thing is that we found that a lot of people kind of wanted to have a more lightweight or just more focused tool. So that's why we kind of created smaller versions, cut down versions of IntelliJ IDEA, such as WebStorm or PyCharm, etc.
Those are great tools. I can't say enough about them, and probably the favorite, but my best times in development are spent in a lot of the IntelliJ platform. So good job on that.
Very true. And the fact that IntelliJ is the platform that you folks have released and made open source is how us Android developers today have a much more pleasant life using Android Studio, because Android Studio currently is possible because of that contribution from your side. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you. And I guess we got to thank Google for building on it as well. So.
Oh, very true. Yeah. That's the other thing. So right now, Google basically has taken that, adopted that, and added like the Android integration. So we thought this is a show for Android developers. And at this point, many Android developers obviously use Android Studio. So who better than you to ask for, to start off, to kick off this episode, 3 or 5 amazing tips for IntelliJ for our listeners?
Sure. So I mean, there's so many, like, you know, I don't want to give shortcuts, but I will. So I kind of say, you know, one of the things that a tip that is not specific as shortcut is when you start to use IntelliJ, any of the IDEs, even Android Studio, which is again built on the same thing, try and unplug the mouse. Really don't use the mouse, because we have consciously put in a lot of effort to make sure that you can use the tool with the keyboard so that you don't have to constantly take your hands away from the keyboard and move to the mouse. And I often find when I look at people, observe people using the tool, or sometimes on Twitter, some people complaining about the tool that, you know, oh, I had to use 7 mouse clicks to do this. You really don't. It's so try and like unplug the mouse and focus on using the keyboard. And one of the things that really allows you to do this is a single keyboard shortcut, which is Shift-Command-A on OS X, or on Windows, it would be Control-Shift-A. And what basically this allows you to do is look up a command. So if I don't know how to do like a rename, for instance, I can press Shift-Command-A, start to type rename, and it will not only allow me to execute the actual action, but it will also give me like a little hint on what the actual keyboard shortcut is. So that's kind of like the main one. And then the other couple of
Actually,
tips that you
I'm
got
to stop you quickly for a second there. The first tip, you have this amazing video that I have to point our listeners to, and it's called Mouseless Driven Development.
Oh yeah, that's an old one.
So I'm gonna add a link, and listeners should make sure they watch that. It's amazing. I just love that video.
Watch the videos, because I kind of go through them again. But really, it is try and memorize those keyboard shortcuts, because they're not that many. And what we're trying to do with each version is focus the keyboard shortcuts to less and less, so that you can, based on the context, you can invoke different actions, not having to memorize all of these different keyboard shortcuts, because primarily also we're running out of combinations as well. So it's going to be hard. And then, you know, the typical command alt O to look for a type or look for a file, etc. Don't use the find box. Try and limit how much you use that, because there's functionality built in that allows you to, that knows about the semantics and the types and of your project. So,
That's an interesting tip. So what you're suggesting, so there's this command that basically says like a find anywhere thing that just pulls up a whole list. You're saying if you can pull the commands that are specific, so if you want to open a class file, for example, you use command O or whatever the equivalent shortcut is, because there are like certain built-in additional functionality to those shortcuts. Is that what you're saying?
Oh yeah, well no, I was referring to the find. So a lot of people actually use like command F, control F to do a search for free text.
Okay.
There is the one you're referring to is the double shift, which is search everywhere. I kind of don't use that for looking up types or files. I still stick to the command O, shift command O, because I find it's, first of all, it's more focused, and I guess maybe out of force of habit, I still kind of stick to that. But yeah, double shift also allows you to kind of like search for anything anywhere. That's often useful for when you like, you want to search for a plugin, or you want to use, you know, switch on and off a navigation bar or something. You can do it with that.
I didn't know you could do that with the with double shift. I just checked it out, and it's that's pretty cool. You can actually turn off features with that double shift. That's cool. Okay, so now those are some pretty cool tips. One of the things that I know that I use, I think even one of our previous guests, Michael Bailey, uses, and maybe even you, Kaushik, you might use it, is the Key Promoter plugin. Do you use that at all, or what do you think of it?
The Key Promoter, the one that kind of says, you know, stop using the mouse or whatever and press this keyboard. Yeah. It's really good in that it's very annoying, so it does its job.
Yes.
So, you know, if we're going to say, is it efficient? Yes, it is. Unless you just say, I've had enough of this and I'm going to switch it off. Personally, I don't use it, because I kind of, you know, most of the keyboard shortcuts I kind of am familiar with. But yeah, if you're starting out, it can be a good thing to use. And often, you know, when I give these talks on tips and tricks, people come to me and say, oh, you know, you didn't mention the Key Promoter, and that I really have found that useful. Yeah, it's kind of like when you press a keyboard shortcut, it shows you the keyboard shortcut that you've pressed. So I kind of say it's very useful when you're doing pair programming. People don't interrupt you and say, what did you just do there? You know, they can actually look at the screen and see what you did.
Okay, so let's hop into one of the biggest topics that a lot of Android developers and just the Android community in general is very, you know, talkative and kind of psyched about is Kotlin. What is Kotlin, and maybe why should we care about it, Howdy?
Okay, so Kotlin is a programming language, open source Apache 2 license programming language that we started working on around coming up to six years ago.
Wow.
It's targeting the JVM, so it compiles down to bytecode. And the main reason that we started to work on this language was because, you know, the majority of our code is written in Java. And despite having created IDEs for so many different languages, we're still sticking to Java for the majority of it. And we were looking for another language that would allow us to cut down the code base a little bit, be a little bit more concise, get rid of some issues that are inherent from languages, such as, you know, null reference pointers, etc. And we started to look at the options that were available at the time. And mainly back then it was Scala, and there were some issues with Scala, namely in terms of the performance aspects and some other issues. And so we said, okay, you know what? Let's try and write our own language, you know. And, you know, most of the tools at JetBrains, if not all, have been actually created out of own need. So it was the next logical step. Well, if we really need a language, why don't we try and create one? And that's kind of why the Kotlin was born. And the primary reason for it was a language for us to use ourselves. But of course, you know, like any language, if it is to be successful, we really want it to get adopted and other people use it as well. And we're hoping that we're pretty much close to the release of 1.0 in the next, I can't tell you exactly, but I'm hoping that it's going to be very soon. But, you know, people have been, both ourselves, and we're really surprised that so many people are actually using it in production. So it's already being used in production.
Just a quick follow-up question. You mentioned earlier that you wanted to stick to the JVM, and that's why you tried to orient Kotlin around the JVM. Any specific reasons why?
Well, a lot of the code that we have, IntelliJ, everything that's IntelliJ or our server-side code, so actually anything that's not our .NET tools is built on Java and on the JVM. And we can't afford to throw that code out. So, you know, we needed a language that would allow us to leverage everything we had. We couldn't just close shop and say, let's take the next 6 years and rewrite all of this. We have to interoperate very firmly, very efficiently and well with the existing code, which was also one of the other issues that we faced when we're doing tests with Scala, which was the interoperability with the JVM.
And that plays in perfectly for us Android developers, because that's the common question. Android has been using Java for some time, as you probably know, and because it's hard to throw away all that existing code, Kotlin seems like the language that is here to save us all.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
So why did you guys choose the name Kotlin, or where did it come from?
Kotlin is an island that's off of St. Petersburg. So one of the JetBrains has basically, I mean, we've got offices in many locations throughout the world, but two of our main R&D offices are located, one in St. Petersburg, Russia, and the other one in Munich, Germany. So Kotlin is an island that's just off of St. Petersburg. So that's the relationship to why we picked Kotlin. It was just a nice island with some nice views. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, that's where it comes from.
And cool. Kotlin, I mean, you folks have been working on Kotlin for quite some time now, right? It isn't like Kotlin was something that just came up. For us Android developers, at least, we've been hearing about Kotlin pretty recently in the last 1 year with more vigor, so to say. But Kotlin is, like you mentioned, you've been using Kotlin for quite some time. It's pretty mature, at least for your internal use at this point, right?
Yes, I mean, we have a few, you know, Kotlin is developed for us to use in our own tools. We are actually using it in some of the tools. We're adopting it in some more tools. And we have already various products in production using Kotlin. So, for instance, JetBrazen Count, some of the eShop stuff, some internal CRM tools, directory tools, people directory tools that we have, all of those are now written in Kotlin. The licensing server, all of these are written in Kotlin. So mission critical applications for us are written in Kotlin. The the uptake in the Android community has, you know, surged in the recent years, as you say. And I'm, you know, we're very grateful for that. And I think that Jake Wharton, which you know, wrote a paper a year ago or so on Kotlin. And that was great. You know, that was a lot of good publicity and coverage for us as well. But yeah, we've been using it for quite a while now.
Nice. And we'll add a link to that paper. That, like you said, is an excellent paper that Jake released. It's very structured and neat, and it's sort of like bits of Kotlin with some other languages. So we'll add a link to that as well to the show notes. All right. So I guess moving in more into the details, you mentioned Kotlin is an open source language. One thing that also comes up in the definition for Kotlin is that it's a statically typed language. So I guess like for our listeners who don't know, there are like different kinds of languages. There's a language that infers basically the types of your variables from the existing source code, which is basically what I guess a statically typed language would be. There are obviously runtime languages as well that figure out the dependencies during runtime. So I believe Ruby is possibly falls in that category. And there are, of course, languages that do a little of both, which most people don't realize it, but Java is actually not purely one of the other. It's this mixed aspect. Can you talk a little about the statically typed, the whole inference aspect of Kotlin? Because I think that's a pretty powerful, it's a very fundamental defining feature of Kotlin, and I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, so there's basically two types, right? There's the statically typed languages and dynamic. Dynamic, like as you say, Ruby, JavaScript, these are dynamic languages, and you have Java, C Sharp, Kotlin, which are static. C Sharp actually has support for what they call the dynamic keyword, which allows you to basically define behavior at runtime. Kotlin is static because we actually, you know, making tools for both static and dynamic languages, we believe that there is better support and more languages, way more toolable when it's static. And we want static languages, and we want to use static languages ourselves. That's why we use Java. So, you know, the choice for us was a no-brainer. We want a static. However, one of the goals of Kotlin was to be concise, not have to be overly explicit constantly. So what Kotlin does have is type inference, which basically means that I don't have to explicitly declare the type of a variable. Let's say, for example, I have a variable of type integer. If I just initialize it to 10, Kotlin knows that this is now an integer initialized with a value of 10. I don't have to explicitly, like in Java, prefix that with int or a string, etc. The type inference itself allows you to really, you know, cut down the amount of boilerplate code that you're writing. And Kotlin allows you to actually declare variables that are mutable or unmutable. So var means a mutable variable, and val means an unmutable variable. So once you give it an assignment, you no longer can change that value. So it would kind of be like the final, I guess, in Java, or the read-only in C Sharp.
Right. That was actually a follow-up question that I had a little later on, which is basically because I noticed in some places where Kotlin is used, there's var and then there's like val, which is V-A-L. And oh, that makes perfect sense now when you say it. Val is immutable, so that is more in the realm of constants, and var is basically your regular variable.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I don't know the exact reason for using var and val, but my understanding just from looking at it initially is, you know, var is variable and val just means value. Would that be correct?
Yeah. So the main reason is that there's a tendency that, you know, and especially with functional programming, in that the less side effects you have, the more correct potentially your program is. Or let's say that there's less surface area for potential issues. So people say, you know, you should start to aim for immutability, because as things are immutable, then you don't have so many side effects. So a lot of languages promote immutability by default. So for example, Scala is immutable by default. In Kotlin, we're not in many aspects immutable by default, but we do allow you to declare immutable things. So whether it's a variable, whether it's a class that's, you know, like for example, the classes in Kotlin by default are final. which are, means that, you know, you cannot inherit from them. You have to explicitly say that you can inherit from a class. So you can create mutable or immutable lists, etc. So it's just kind of the less, you know, if I declare a variable and then three lines down change it and then somewhere else in a loop change it, there's more chances of things going wrong. There's more potential areas that I would have to test. Whereas if I declare it immutable, I know that the value is what it is, wherever it is initialized. So I, for example, myself, you know, tend very much to force immutability. So when I'm writing code, I try and make sure the code, you know, my variables are immutable.
Have you found when you're writing that functional style of language that it took some type of paradigm shift from, you know, the previous languages that you're working in? And if so, what was something that helped you bridge that gap?
Yeah, it does. It's still an issue. I mean, you know, you still have to kind of think a little bit, stop focusing so much on classes, stop focusing so much on this aspect of objects and start thinking that, you know, it's just, you know, why can't I just create functions? And the, basically the idea is that I think one of the things that really helped me was start to treat functions as first class citizens, which is the one of the essences of functional programming. So, you know, we are very much used to patterns such as, for instance, dependency injection or strategy pattern, where you have a class and then you inherit from that class, changing somewhat the behavior. And if you look at the strategy pattern, you're creating, you know, a hierarchy of classes and then creating all these objects just to change a specific behavior. So why not try and encapsulate that behavior in a function and just pass that function around, you know, and do away with all of that indirection that often isn't really necessary to accomplish what it is that you're trying to do. There's an actual very good article from years ago. I think it's by Steve Yeager. It's called Verbs in the Kingdom of Nouns or something like that. And it talks about the you know, the simile between verbs being actions and nouns being kind of like the objects.
I remember reading that article.
Yeah. It's old, but very good.
Very cool. We'll add a link to that as well. Quick question that I have from before. You mentioned that one of the goals of Kotlin was to be concise. And I noticed on the main page, kotlinlang.org, you have these goals that are there. Can you talk a little about them? For example, one like being concise, being safe, being versatile, being interoperable. What's with those goals? And I guess like the reason I ask is because at this point you have experience building your own language. So how important was it to adhere to those goals?
Very important. And still it is very important because, I mean, we designed this language, we created this language for a specific purpose. And the purpose was for us to use it. And this is what our requirements were. So we wanted a language that is concise because, you know, not to continuously have to write boilerplate code over and over again. To a certain extent, you could say, well, that's actually contradicting ourselves because, you know, IntelliJ generates a lot of boilerplate code for you. But IntelliJ also does a lot of other things as well, right? The safeness is because, again, trying to avoid some of the potential issues that you run into during runtime, such as null reference exceptions and typecasting, etc. Well, typecasting, that's in terms of the conciseness as well. The functional aspect or the modern, I guess, is kind of, again, because of the conciseness, because of the focus on, you know, focusing on what it is, the intent, what we also did is provide support for the kind of like the functional first class citizens with the functions. We also focus on toolable. Again, because we are a tooling company and we really want to make sure that the languages that we create, we can provide the tooling for. And then I think there's the interoperability aspect. Absolutely. Because as I said, you know, we have so much existing code base, and we need to make sure that we can still use this code base. So Kotlin is done in a way that I can take a Java project, add a Kotlin file to it, and start to write code in Kotlin, from Kotlin talk to Java, from Java talk to Kotlin. So really seamless integration between the two languages and the ability to not have to reinvent the entire ecosystem. A lot of people, when they come to Kotlin, they're like, okay, where's the web framework? Where is the, you know, the dependency injection framework? No, the whole point is that you can actually use everything you already have. Now, what you can do, and people are starting to do, is add like very thin facades, surface areas onto the language, kind of giving it a little bit more of an idiomatic Kotlin approach, but under the covers, using all of the existing frameworks. So, you know, it's trying to always align with those goals that we set out.
Now, we can use different, you know, if I want to use Dagger or whatever, I can use Dagger for my dependency injection framework, and I can use Kotlin with it. That's cool. The one question that might be coming up for some developers is, does compiling down to bytecode take longer than typical Java when you're using Kotlin?
It is right now slower than Java, yes. Okay. When we're in, on each iteration, especially now reaching the kind of like the end goals, not end, I mean, reaching the release stages, we're focusing a lot on the performance. So we've, you know, we've got incremental compilation. We have made improvements for Gradle and Maven. So we are trying to improve the speed because one of our requirements is, and one of the goals was, to be at least as fast as Java. And we're still constantly working on that. I can tell you that right now it is faster than Scala, significantly faster than Scala. The runtime is significantly smaller than Scala as well. But yeah, it is still not at the same speed as Java.
Now, the I guess the main question was, is that in regards to compilation, or is that in regards to actual execution at runtime?
Oh, no, just compilation. Runtime, okay, there's no difference. Yeah, runtime, good. There's no difference. In fact, on some tests, some things we've done, the bytecode that we generate, is it results in more efficient performance.
So just to talk a little about this 100% Java interoperability, what exactly happens right now is the code that gets compiled down is actually the exact same bytecode that you can run on a JVM, right? So like these are, in the end, almost like dot class files. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so basically you write language in Kotlin and it's sort of like transpiled into this class.
Compiled down to bytecode, yeah. Directly. It's not actually converting it to Java code or anything like that, transpiling into another language. It is actually compiling down to bytecode. We also have support for JavaScript, but right now the main focus has been on the JVM side. But yeah, it generates the bytecode.
So, and the advantage of that is basically then you can run it on any JVM, right? So
absolutely.
Like if your JVM is one from the six, like JDK 6 or JDK 7 or even 8 as we move forward, then the exact same code works.
Yes, and that's one of our goals as well, because, you know, we know that not everyone is on JDK 8. We know that not everyone is using Java 8. And that's one of the reasons why it's gotten this adoption on Android platform, because we have support for lambdas, and yet you can target JDK 6 or 7. So, you know, even though you're targeting JDK 6, you can still use lambdas. So you can use, you know, higher level functions and pass functions around and use lambdas just as you would if you were using Java 8, which is why it makes it so attractive also on the Android platform, because, you know, all of those event handlers, etc., can just be done away with by just passing in a function.
As I was talking to Kaushik before the show, about an hour before the show, and I said that, you know, Java, sometimes I feel like I don't like it. And I think the analogy that I use is something similar to, like, Java is like Java 6 or 7 that we're playing with in Android world right now is kind of like playing Super Nintendo, like N64. It was fun, but eventually, something new comes out and you want to play that. But for some reason, you are stuck dealing with this old video game. And eventually, while it's still fun, you just kind of get tired of it. And I feel that a lot of people feel that way about Java. I know I do. I would love to use the new stuff. And so just you saying that I can use lambdas and it compiles down properly immediately makes me want to go take Kaushik's RX examples GitHub repository and turn it into Kotlin just so I can see the power of it and how much code I can reduce. So it's excellent news. I'm super excited to hear that.
Well, I mean, we don't have like firm statistics, but I mean, some of the stuff that we've done, we kind of estimate that you could potentially, again, it really does depend on your code base, but we could potentially reduce it by about 40%. Wow. But the important thing here is, you know, you can make really, really small amount of code that is completely undecipherable. We still focus on readability and maintainability. So that reduction doesn't take away that readability. And in fact, some of the things that we've built into Kotlin, which is like, for instance, extension functions, which if you're familiar with C#, the idea is that you can take an existing class, be it Java or Kotlin, and add a new function to it, add a new method to it, and then just invoke that function. So the ability to do that, the ability to have top-level functions, which basically mean that I can just declare a function in a file without having to tie it onto an object, allows also the ability to create kind of like DSLs in a very simple way. So that's one of the things that we've provided also is a framework which is called Anko for Kotlin, for Android developers, which allows you to do kind of strongly typed, statically typed view definitions of your Android views, just using a very simple language as opposed to XML.
So there are a couple of things that I guess when we talk about trying to use Kotlin for Android, we'll get into Anko as well. But Anko is essentially like the layout XML bits. If you want to get rid of those aspects, it's like the replacement for that. Because there's also something called Kotlin Android extensions, if I'm right, which is, I think, a little different, right?
Yes, that's a little bit different. Yeah.
Okay, cool. When we go into the section about Android, I guess, we'll talk a little more in detail about that. One quick follow-up. You made a statement previously saying that in certain situations, the JVM, the bytecode that gets generated is actually more efficient than what you would see with older JVMs, with maybe JVM 6, JDK 6, 7, etc. So I'm guessing Kotlin has a separate VM. What has been your experience with that? Because obviously, since you have more control, and I guess JetBrains as an organization is way more nimble than possibly Oracle. So I guess you can iterate pretty faster on that. Does the code that actually gets generated, the final bytecode, have you seen performance improvements with that specifically compared to what you would otherwise get by using Java?
There are certain areas where, for example, using inline functions or in those areas, we have seen a little bit of performance increase, but nothing that I could really point to, because, you know, a lot of the times these types of benchmarks have to not only be done from a, you know, very, very objective point of view, but also there's the warm-up time. You have to run it on many machines. You have to run it on, you know, different JDKs, different JVMs. And it's just hard to kind of like publish the results without doing enough. So I would be reluctant to actually say, in this specific scenarios, but we have done some tests, but I think until we don't do more thorough ones, I wouldn't want to really make that claim right now.
I guess the point I was trying to get to is, for example, the exact specific one you mentioned, which is inlining. For example, in using getters and setter methods, like a smart JVM would inline those, or if you have constants or static functions being referenced, a smart JVM basically inlines those calls. So I guess a lot of that is built in.
Yeah, and what Kotlin allows you to do is actually explicitly mark a method as inline. So when it is possible, it allows you to do that. And then you can combine that. For example, we allow for inline functions, you can have reified generics, which are not available as such on the JVM. So for certain scenarios, yeah, you could actually do explicit inlining, much the same way with like tail recursion. So Kotlin also has an annotation that allows you to, you know, if a function is tail recursive, you can annotate it as tail recursive. And then when the compiler generates the bytecode, it knows how to basically create a for loop with that.
Oh, that is pretty cool. So at this point, I guess we should dive in a little more into the specifics of Kotlin as a language. One very interesting feature that I've noticed is that you can basically return values from functions inline, right? So, and what I mean is, a good example of this is like if you have an if-else block of code, you can basically assign the value that's returned from this if-else block into a variable. Can you talk a little more about that and like some of the powers that the blocks and the functions provide?
Okay, so functions that you can have single line functions, which is basically a function with no body, and that just just equals some value, and that value can be again because of the type inference, you don't even have to explicitly indicate the return type or anything like that. And then of course, pretty much everything is an expression in Kotlin, so that you can also return expressions directly. Then if you get into a little bit more of the advanced scenario, so to speak, you have loops, and then the loops can have labels, and then you can return from some of these mark returns from the labels, which is useful when you're using, for example, lambdas at some points to know how to return from the outer and inner blocks. But it's very much focused around trying to make it concise and at the same time keep into mind a lot of these aspects of functional programming. So, functional programming, like there's a lot of, treating things like expressions. Because again, if I have an if block and that if block starts to manipulate data around it, I'm moving away from the whole, side effect free aspects.
So speaking about Lambda, since you brought it up, obviously that's one of the biggest pulls for us Android developers. How does the actual mechanism work? So if I have a Lambda written in Kotlin, when it gets compiled down, does it compile down to the equivalent of like an anonymous inner class, or does it use like the Java 8 sort of equivalent, or how does that work?
No, it basically compiles down because we need to keep the JD Java 6 compatibility. It compiles down to anonymous classes. Later there is talk about using alternatives with invoke dynamic, etc. But right now it does use the anonymous classes.
Okay, because one problem at least that I've seen is when you use anonymous inner classes, and we've talked about this in past episodes, is it has a reference to like the parent class, and that can at some point lead to certain leaks in terms of memory. Is that accounted for in Kotlin, for example, only if you do have a if you explicitly use, because I believe that's how Java 8 does its lambdas. If you explicitly call a variable in a parent, only then does it keep a reference. Otherwise, at that point, it doesn't keep a reference.
I believe that is accounted for. Okay. I wouldn't be able to give you the nitty-gritty details, but I believe mm-hmm. that it is.
Okay, cool. You talked also a little bit, and I think you referred to this before, and I want to call it out because I think it's a pretty cool feature, which is this whole smart kind of casting. For example, once you pass a check, for example, if you check to see if a variable is of type string, after that, subsequently in your code, what you can do is essentially just use it like a string. So you could call dot length and size or whatever the other functions are on a string. How does, is that true? I mean, I don't want to assume features that aren't present.
Yeah. So that is, again, it's trying to cut down on boilerplate code. So the idea is if the compiler can validate that a specific type, a specific object is of a specific type, then why go to the extra effort of casting it? So in your case, let's say I have a function and I'm passing in a type customer. A type person, and then inherited from person is a customer. So if in that function I do if object is the customer, then invoke customer make preferred, I don't have to now again cast that object to a type customer, because the compiler can say, well, yes, you've already checked that this is of type customer. You don't need to tell me again that it's going to be of type customer. The compiler should be smart enough to detect that. So that's what the smart casts are about.
Okay, and this might seem like it's called autocasts. And this might seem like a stupid question, but assuming you have an object that extends multiple types, and you do this type check at a subsequent point. So on line 5, you check for it to be a string. On line 7, you check for it to be something else that extends a string. That point, could you subsequently use it both as you could call methods of a string or that specific object? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on, you know, how the actual code is. First of all, there's no multiple inheritance. But if you have, as long as a compiler can deduce it, it should work. I'm not sure if that exact scenario would work. I don't know what exactly it would be in code, but if the compiler can detect that it is valid, it will. If the compiler feels that it's ambiguous, then it won't. It will actually say, this is ambiguous, I don't know how to cast it, so you're going to have to do an explicit cast.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. So there are fallbacks. For example, if the compiler throws an error saying, hey, I don't understand how this is supposed to be working, then you can explicitly indicate to the compiler that this is how it should be working, which is actually pretty cool because then it allows you to handle all those edge cases that would otherwise be very difficult to handle.
Correct. Yeah.
Cool. Speaking about safety, so one, and actually this, in a recent DroidCon video that was put up, basically there's this, I'm not exactly sure, but I'll add a link. The title of the talk is Kotlin, A New Hope.
And yeah, that's why, yeah, I think it's Michael Pardo.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
That is correct. We'll add a link to that as well. He mentioned one aspect of safety. For example, in Java, you can have covariant arrays, which is kind of cool, but also extremely dangerous. And what this means is if you have an array of type object and you have an object array, and the very first object that you assign to it is a string. So you say object of 0 is equal to, hello or something is a string. And subsequently, you do object of 1 or 2 is equal to an integer. The compiler at this point, because it thinks it's just an object, the compiler wouldn't throw an error. But on runtime, this thing would blow up. And I guess that's like one of the problems. And this is an example he called out. So does Kotlin actually have covariant arrays, or does it just handle it in a much more elegant way altogether?
It does. It has kind of what's called the site covariants. So it's a little bit different to how Java handles it. Trying to, again, keep into the restrictions of the safety so that you won't have issues at runtime. So when there is so Kotlin favors the aspect of, you know, making sure that if it's not available, that there is ambiguity, it wouldn't allow you to do a runtime, prevent a runtime exception. It's kind of the same aspect as the null safety. I don't know if we brought that up. I mean, I remotely mentioned that, you know, it's null safe. So Kotlin by default, and when we're talking about variables and types, etc., you do not, a type cannot have null value. So when I declare a string, it cannot be null by default. You can explicitly make it null by adding a question mark to it, right? So what happens here is that now, unless, you know, if I don't have nulls, I don't have to check for nulls. I don't have to now worry about, you know, if this value is not null, then do this. If that value is not null, then do that.
Which is the source of probably 50% of all problems in the Android world as well.
Yeah. But the issue again there is that, but we interoperate with Java, and Java loves nulls, right? So how do we deal with this? And there's been various approaches throughout the lifetime of Kotlin. There's been the ability to annotate libraries. There's been the ability to leave it up to the user, etc. And we've tried to reach some kind of compromise. So for instance, in Kotlin, when you use a type from Java, it imports the type, and it has a question mark, right? And the question mark says that this can potentially be null. So we call it the Elvis operator. So now you can invoke using the Elvis operator saying, only if this value is not null, then invoke this method on it. So trying to, again, allow you to use the program in a safe way to prevent runtime null reference exceptions. But like everything, you can eventually end up shooting yourself in the foot. And we developers love to do that, don't we?
Yeah, I recently read an article. I forget where it was, but it was something about advocating against the use of nulls because of all the side effects that it can introduce.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the article of the billion-dollar mistake of, you know, the null is the billion-dollar mistake. I find it when I started to use Kotlin, because in C# you also had non-nullable, so you had the opposite. You could say that something is not nullable, and it is kind of hard to start thinking that, you know, let's stop having nulls. Let's just deal with variables and values that aren't nulls.
That's like saying let's just stop with Starbucks. I mean, everyone at this point just drinks Starbucks every day, and everyone knows it's probably so bad for them. But at this point, you can't like remove Starbucks. It would just affect the whole fabric of the American nation.
So we've talked a little bit about some of the language specifics about Kotlin, which is cool. There's a lot of cool features that I would like to use. I know this morning before the call, I even created a test project to really remind myself some of the features that I had seen months ago and kind of play with it. And I found myself interested, but it also at the same time, I kind of felt like I didn't really know where to start. What would be the best way to kind of get started with Kotlin as an Android developer? What do you think would be the best way?
Okay, so this is a little bit of a trick. Well, not trick. It's a little bit difficult, and I'll try and explain. So the best place to start with Kotlin, to learn Kotlin, is if you go to kotlinlang.org. Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of tutorials there. We have the entire reference guide. Then there's a whole bunch of tutorials using. In fact, there is a couple for using mobile development as well, getting started with Android development. Okay. It also talks about Kotlin Android extensions. There's also two books now in the works. There's one by Kotlin in Action, which is by Dmitry Yemirov and Svetlana Isakova. They're colleagues of mine. That's a Manning book. And then there is Antonio Leiva, a guy from Spain, has written Kotlin for Android developers. And that's available on LeanPub. But the thing is that a lot of tutorials, etc., are kind of done with IntelliJ IDEA, because you can still do Android development either using IntelliJ IDEA Ultimate or using IntelliJ IDEA Community Edition, which is a free and open source one. But if you're coming to Android Studio, there are kind of a few subtle differences, but it's mostly in some screens and maybe a little bit in terms of the build system. When it comes to the actual language and what you can and cannot do, it's basically the same. But the comment I made is that it's a little bit difficult is because if you're completely new and you're new to Android development and you're new to Kotlin and you're new to Android Studio, then it becomes a little bit like, where am I meant to go? But if you know the environment or you're new or you know Android, then basically go to Kotlin Lang docs reference and there you can get up and running very easily. There's also on the tutorials, there's a very good tutorial by my colleague Sveta, which is called the Kotlin Koans, which is basically a whole bunch of like 40 or 50 exercises that you could just clone on GitHub and just go through them. And it gets you up and running with the syntax and also with the idioms. So it goes through conventions, properties, builders, collections, generics, nice. Everything. Nice. Really good. And it's all based on tests. So you just have to get these tests passing.
What? Did you say tests?
Yeah.
Wow, that's like a foreign word in Android.
Yeah. I guess in Android they can do the you saw the Volkswagen tests now.
Oh
yeah, someone released a little GitHub project for PHP that they called it the Volkswagen test, which is you install this on your continuous integration server and everything always passes.
Genius.
Oh yeah. It's clever. I like it.
Yeah.
10,000 passing tests in 3 seconds.
Yeah, and all green.
Yeah.
The Coens thing is actually pretty cool. I've had a look at it before. I also love the name, by the way. So for those who don't know, a koan is like a Buddhist thing, right? It's basically like something that you meditate on. People should look for it. But yeah, koans is pretty cool. And I guess that's why the name was chosen. So as you start going through each of these koans, you start to understand the inspiration behind Kotlin and how to use it in the right way.
And also, if you don't want to even like download Kotlin or download IntelliJ or anything like that, you can go to try.kotlinlang.org. And there's a kind of like an interactive IDE or editor with a compile and run options that you can do exercises there and just write Kotlin code and run inside the browser without having to download anything.
How does that actually work? I've always been curious because it works so well. I mean, do you basically just get the text, send it back to a backend server, do the usual processing in Coen, and then spit the results back out in the browser? Or have you built something like special?
This is actually, it uses a compiler as a service. So we've got the backend that's invoking the compiler. And what we do is just use some JavaScript to send the text back. And then we also have the ability to highlight issues by doing on-the-fly type checking. But that's basically just sending the text and getting it back from the server and then giving you the feedback. Much the same way when you run it, it runs it, and then it outputs the results on the client side.
Another video, we'll add all these in the show notes so people can have a good idea about where to go. There was another video that I saw. This is quite early. It was Kotlin in 2 minutes, which is sort of like if, you know, you're just having lunch and you're curious about Kotlin, this was an interesting video.
We recently also, it was like a week and a half ago, we launched a Slack channel because everyone does Slack nowadays.
Yeah.
And so that's at kotlinlang.slack.com. And we've already got close to 400 people on it.
Wow. Okay.
Which is really great because on our IRC channel, we only had like 50 people.
IRC? Like, what's that?
Yes. Yes. I actually had someone on Twitter the other day say, why do you use Slack? You know, we love IRC. I'm like, well, I don't know, man. It's like people move on.
So now when I use the Android stuff this morning, I did have to install a plugin inside of Android Studio. Is that still the case for what we need to do if we want to install it inside of Android Studio, or do we have to run inside of IntelliJ?
No, you can install inside of Android Studio. The thing is that, you know, Android Studio is not our product. It's Google's.
Yep.
So we can't define what ships out of the box. But with IntelliJ IDEA, we actually, from 15, we will be shipping, hopefully, well, it already ships in the EAPs, Kotlin out of the box. But with Android Studio, it's just simply a matter of just going to plugins and install Kotlin. And that's it. It's very simple. Otherwise it works fine.
And there are some pretty cool things about using Kotlin and IntelliJ. For example, you can point to a Java class file and basically just hit an option somewhere in IntelliJ and say convert to Kotlin, right? Yep.
Yeah, there's in the code menu, there's an option to say convert a Java file to Kotlin, which is really, really good when you're just picking up the language. So we've actually made Kotlin so... You know, people say, this is not really different from Java. And we're like, yes, we know, on purpose, because that is our goal. We want people to ramp up very fast. So we don't want to make a completely new syntax, completely new paradigm. But even so, when you're starting with Kotlin, sometimes you're like, how would I do this class in Kotlin? And you can just take the file, convert it to Kotlin inside IntelliJ.
Looks like that shortcut is Alt-Shift-Command-K for OS X developers.
Yeah.
And some time back, you also mentioned there's this... So you mentioned Anko, and then there's the Kotlin Android extension. So I'm a little confused about where I would use what. So could you throw some light on that?
Okay, so the Anko is kind of the layout that we were talking about, the DSL for creating layouts. But it also has a bunch of utility extensions. So not only does it have the layout aspects of the DSL, but it also has a bunch of functions that make it easier for you to when you're writing code for Android. The Kotlin extensions, that's a plugin that's available for IntelliJ IDEA and Android Studio, which allows you to statically or strongly reference elements in your view. So instead of writing, you know, find by ID view something and then cast that to something else, like a button, you can just reference it by the name. You can just say button one dot. And it uses plugin technology into the compiler, because the compiler has support for plugins to get that information. So as you're working with the code, you have that reference directly.
Interesting. So basically, today, many Android developers use this library by Jay called Butterknife. So I guess it sort of it helps with some of those requirements.
Yes.
This is also interesting because Jake also has rewritten Butterknife in Kotlin, and it's called Cotterknife, if I remember correctly.
So yeah.
That's also...
There is that. Everything that is written in Kotlin is now prefixed with a K.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So that's pretty cool. People can have a look at it. One point he mentioned in the document, and sorry to jump over the place, but I thought it was interesting, is... There are certain features of the JVM compiler, like annotation processors, that isn't supported by the Kotlin compiler. But, I mean, he immediately points out, well, there's no need for that specifically. One thing, so Dagger, Butterknife, many of these use annotation processors, right? So how does Kotlin basically obviate the need for that? I mean, does it... I'm guessing Kotlin provides mechanisms to not have these in the first place. Right. Is that
well,
a fair statement?
not in all cases, and I believe that I'm not certain. I would have to double check on this, but I think that in one of the latest ones, we already have solved partially some of those problems with the annotation processes. But I, you know, there are still certain areas where people still use it and you know, kind of need it. So some things are solved, other things doesn't really, still we're ironing out some of the issues. But I would probably have to check, because I think that's in that area we did, I mean, we have provided CAPT, which is our Kotlin annotation processor tool itself that allows you to circumvent some of these. It's annotation processing for Kotlin. Send a link to that as well.
Yes. It's called CAPT, you mentioned?
Yeah. K-A-P-T.
Okay. Cool.
So, and that is also because of a shortcoming on the, well, an issue with the with the way the API on Java works. So it's kind of like, you know, trying to solve that in some sense.
Well, there's a couple of sample projects. I think that helps me a lot when I'm developing or learning a new language and taking a look at example code, either through the convert to Kotlin function, which is inside of Android Studio that we just talked about, or sometimes it's just nice to be able to sit down and read the code of, like, how is this working? You know, how are we going from screen to screen? What are these transitions and so forth? So there's a couple of projects here that we know about, and just talk about those for a second. So if anyone's interested, they will be in the show notes. One is called Palette Helper, and it's a project written in Kotlin, and it's just a utility app to help generate color palettes using the palette library from Google. So you can check that one out. It's completely written in Kotlin. The other one is called CineZap Android Kotlin. And it just has some more demonstrations of how you can install Kotlin and K Annotator plugin. So I'm not too familiar with that, but if that sounds interesting to you, feel free to check that out. And then the other one that we have listed here is Kotlin Demo. And it's just basic sample Android application written in Kotlin, and basically allows you to show the, you know, connect to a list of base stations that are available for Wi-Fi, and you can kind of see the details about them. So if you are kind of want to dive in head first, check out those sample applications. Should help you understand Kotlin a little bit better.
So I guess at this point, we should maybe talk about, like, the overall advantages and disadvantages of using Kotlin, if any. So obviously, we have sprinkled the advantages all throughout. It's open source, which is a huge, huge important requirement for any language, new language that's being developed in these days. It's obviously backed by JetBrains, and you mentioned that you're using it in, like, your production, in a sense, in your production code. There's first-class IDE support, so all of that really does play to its advantages. Are there any other points that you'd like to sort of like draw out, Harry?
Yeah, I mean, we also, you know, as I said, it is backed by JetBrains. We are actively invested in it. You know, we're using it ourselves. So there's certain guarantees that, you know, it's not going anywhere. We also have made it really clear that this isn't about tie-in. You know, we not only provide all the same functionality for Kotlin in the open source community edition of IntelliJ, as well as Android Studio, but we're also working on an Eclipse plugin, which we've released. And we're hoping that at some point the community starts to pick that one up, but we are actively contributing to it. So I think that the important thing here is with Kotlin, because of the goals and making sure that the ramp up time is low, I know that everyone evaluates their risks differently, but the learning curve is very low. So you can, and the fact that it's interoperable, it does minimize the risks of actually incorporating it into your project. Because at the end of the day, I mean, I guess both of you can speak about this better than myself, but if you look at Kotlin code, in a couple of hours, you can understand exactly what is happening. You know, there's very little in Kotlin that you kind of like, you know, scratch your head and say, what exactly is going on here? So we've focused very much on keeping conciseness, but not sacrificing readability for that. So these advantages, I guess, you know, give you the ability to start to use it a little bit in your code. And of course, we'll eventually get more improved support for JavaScript. I mean, we now target JavaScript, but there's still a bit more left to do on that. So that also gives you the ability to sometimes you need to share code between your client and server, like validation of business logic, etc. You can now write that code in Kotlin once and have it used, you know, node modules on the server side with JavaScript server side, or modules on the client side in the browser, and also just use it straight up JVM code on the, you know, targeted JVM on the server side. So I think in terms of advantages, those are some of them, I guess.
Quick question, can Kotlin actually be used like a scripting language?
There is a little bit of support, but not the support that we would be comfortable with saying yes. But we will work on that, but not just yet, not for the 1.0 release.
Now, that's some of the advantages that Kotlin has had and so forth. Now, there's some disadvantages that I see initially, and perhaps we can touch on those. And one of them is mainly that it is another language that you have to learn. And as a developer, or even sometimes as business owners that are having applications developed, that can be troublesome to find people that know this language already. Have you seen anything or heard anything about that at all?
It is. I mean, we get that feedback. You know, we do, people, especially in enterprise shops, say, well, you know, how can I risk this? You know, how can I tell my customer that, hey, I'm just going to adopt a new language? There is nothing that we can do really from our side apart from, you know, yes, it's backed by us. Yes, we're going to be around. Yes, our business model doesn't revolve around Kotlin. So it's not that if Kotlin doesn't sell, we stop developing it, because that's not our business model around it. But we have a 16-year track history of being a profitable company and, you know, being self-sustained. So, but obviously, yes, there is that issue. But again, I hope that the ability for people to easily pick up the language, the similarities that it has with C#, JavaScript, Java, might also be a bonus in saying, actually, this isn't completely learning a new language. You know, this isn't me going from being a Java developer to a Haskell developer, or me being from Java to Clojure. It is quite similar. It's kind of similar structures, similar control flow, functions, methods, objects, all of that still exists. So that aspect hopefully counterweighs a little bit the other things.
Now, some of the things that I've also seen it, and this is recently a post that relates to a post that Joel Spolsky from Fog Creek Software, which is, if you're not familiar with them, it's the group that's helped create Stack Overflow and Trello and so forth. They recently announced that in one of their initial flagship products, Fog Bugs, that they finally got rid of the last piece of Wasabi code in their code base. Now, for those, again, not familiar, Wasabi was a language that Fog Bugs created for their product, Fog Bugs. Some people say that is kind of the reason why Jira ended up winning the battle between Fog Bugs and Jira, if there even was a battle. How does JetBrains plan to get around that as a new language? Or I guess maybe the bottom line is JVM the saving grace here?
I read that post. It's interesting. It's also interesting because we have UTrack. Which is our issue tracker, mm-hmm. and we wrote out of our frustration with another one that we used, and we used a language for UTrack called MPS, it's called Metaprogramming System. It's an open source product that we have for many years, which is a programming workbench. So it allows you to create your own DSLs, your own language, and provide the refactoring and tooling at the same time. very great for certain areas. We used that for UTrack. We felt some shortcomings. So when I read that, I'm like, yes, we had our own kind of language for UTrack, but ours, to a certain point, you know, it was also extension of Java in some aspects. But again, this is about the JVM. I guess the JVM does save us because this is just another language. And the fact that, you know, we are just another language on the JVM,
yep.
You know, it's a little bit different to .NET. .NET, people say it's a polyglot environment. Yes, as long as it's C#. Yes, right. there is VB. There is a bunch of people really wanting to push F#, which is a fantastic language. But look at Microsoft, and their focus is C#. JVM is not so much like that. You know, there is more democratization, so to speak, of languages. And people do use Scala. People do use, you know, Ceylon, people do use Java, Clojure. So I think that there's a little bit more, as you say, the JVM is our saving grace, so to speak.
Gotcha. Okay.
Makes sense. Some last questions here. Do you know if, and I ask this as an Android developer, so I have definitely a lot of, this is something I'm definitely extremely interested about. Do you know if Google is actually pushing for Kotlin instead of Java? Can you give us information? Because we have tried to press a bunch of Google developers and they've kept quiet about it.
Come on, Hadi.
I wish I could, but I honestly don't know. There's been nothing from our side in terms of, you know, there's been no approach from our side or from Google's side to say, yep, let's make Kotlin the default language for Android. Well, nothing. I'm nothing in that aspect. So I wish I could comment and say, yes, that's it, but nope, nothing. For us, it would be awesome. It would be amazing. But until now, there isn't. So I don't know. Maybe when we release 1.0, there will be. I don't know. So I do know that there was some prototypes and stuff written at some point by the Android Studio team. For the data access stuff in Java and Kotlin as prototypes. And we do have a bunch of people from Google that are using it and love it. I mean, even on Slack channel the other day, I was speaking to a developer from Google that is using Kotlin. But there is no official stance on that, unfortunately.
Makes sense. We had to ask. I mean,
So you spoke of when 1.0 comes out. So last question here. When do you expect a stable 1.0 release for Kotlin to come out?
We have been stabilizing the language in the last couple of releases. And as you've seen, we've gone from nearly weekly milestone releases when before it was kind of like a few months. So I would say that it's very, very close. I really wish I could give you a firm date. But having said dates before and not complying with them, I prefer not to anymore. But I can just tell you that we're really aiming for it to be very close. The language is mostly stabilized. We're just getting rid of a lot of the things, the mistakes that we initially made and changes and working on stabilizing the IDEs and bugs. There's no major issues planned, no major changes planned anymore for the language. And as again, because we are actively at the same time simultaneously developing the IDE and the tooling, we have a very good migration story. So normally when we make a release, we say, okay, in the next release, these things are going to be deprecated. And we announce that, and we also give you the heads up in the compiler. And we say, in the next release, this is going to be deprecated. And we give you an Alt-Enter quick action intention in IntelliJ to say, hit Alt-Enter and fix it, you know, for you. And then the next version will come and basically deprecate that functionality. So we're trying to make the migration story as easy as possible for people.
That is such a fantastic point. Yeah, it's so easy because you have such deep integration with the IDE. It's almost like flipping a switch. And so you can, in fact, push developers to sort of adopt changes in the languages pretty fast. I think that's a really huge point.
Yeah, and we actually make sure that every language change has the functionality in the IDE as well.
Now, I hate to be devil's advocate, but I know a lot of other developers are thinking the same thing I am. Soon is a subjective term. Would you say that you're thinking the release is in the next 3 months or 3 to 6 or maybe just within the next year?
Well, I'm clinging on to the hashtag no estimates. No.
All right. Okay. Sticking hard. He's sticking to it.
Off the record, if you wouldn't have to hold me on this, but I would say hopefully in the next 3 months. Hopefully.
Awesome. Thank you, Adi.
I'm wrong. If I'm right, hey, I'm the hero.
Right.
Yeah, you're an oracle if you're it. So.
Oh, I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
All right. Thank you so much, Adi. I think this has been amazing. And it's fun to see, especially now, the amount of integration Kotlin has, especially with Android. It looks like there's a very interesting story to be told in the Android world for using Kotlin as a primary language. At this point, I guess we should wind the show down because we've been having too much fun with Adi and we have to at some point let him go because I believe he also has some work to do at JetBrains. We wind the show usually down with some awesome picks. So Don, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I can go ahead and start us off. So one of mine actually relates to yours, so I'm going to leave that one until right after you're done. But the first one that I'd like to share is I recently finished the audiobook called The Martian, and I know that movie came out, so some people have probably seen the movie. But if you have not seen the movie and you have not read the book, go download the audiobook and the link's in the show notes. It's probably the best audiobook I've ever listened to. The voice acting on it is unbelievable. I can't say any book that I've ever listened to has been that good. So check it out. It's a great book. It's, you know, completely gets you into a different realm. The other thing I'd like to share is Antonio's book on Kotlin. I would like to include the link in the show notes for that. That's I've been taking a little bit look at that. Looks very interesting. And ancillary to that is also check out his blog, Antonio Leiva. I'm probably butchering that. It'll be in the show notes. Sorry, Antonio. He has tons of great information, tons of great Android topics on his blog. So check out his blog when you get a chance.
Absolutely. Very smart guy. And he's been releasing some really cool Android posts as well. Cool. Hadi, do you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. I've actually read something that's completely not related to Android or Kotlin, but it came out a couple of days ago, and I think that it's important for all of us as developers. I don't know if you're familiar with Safe Harbor. Have you heard of the term Safe Harbor? Which was basically, yeah. So I don't know if you guys heard that recently, 2 days ago, the EU court ruled in favor of a gentleman that had sued Facebook saying that I don't want my data to leave Europe. And that's going to have implications over the Safe Harbor Agreement. And I don't know, Microsoft has just today released a post saying that how they're going to, you know, react to this and that your data is safe and that. But essentially what it's saying is that if we're creating applications, if we've got our data, we got to now start to make sure that, you know, maybe data from European individuals cannot leave Europe and go and be stored in the US or potentially vice versa. Although this is more in effect from the Europe to the US side. So I think that that's an interesting thing for all of us as developers. And the other one I was going to mention is if this show comes out before Java 1 takes place, if you are in the neighborhood, apart from us having a booth and being there, ping me. And because we're going to do a small little party for some of the members of our community and specifically for Kotlin developers. So if you're there, ping me and I'll give you a nice invite.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Thanks, Harry.
Yeah.
When is Java 1? Java 1 is the 25th of October, right?
Yeah, the last week. And if you're not going there for the Java, you've definitely got to go there for the Elton John concert.
Oh yeah,
I know some people will kill me for saying that.
Nice. Okay, so my awesome picks for these for this week is actually just two generic tips that I thought were pretty interesting as I was developing. One is whenever you're looking for solutions to a problem, I've noticed the general tendency is to basically jump on Stack Overflow and use search terms that sort of match your same problem, but as you start getting a little more experienced, I think a much more sensible alternative is to actually go and look into the source code. So if you find something is not working with your view layouts or your view groups or something, and you're trying to understand how this would work or what option you need to add in order to make the view work in a way that you want, the best way is to actually dive into the source code. And this is the advantage with dealing in open source languages or platforms. You can look at the source code. You have access to the source code. You should immediately jump in and actually look at the source code. I found that the advantage is, A, obviously you'll find the best source of truth to the solution for your problem. And B, it also, you start to touch on different other topics and you have a better sense or understanding of how the platform works. So I found that to be extremely, this is a tip that I basically give out to people who ask for generic tips. So I thought I should let our listeners know that as well. The other one is I've noticed as your project becomes bigger, I recently moved to this company called Instacart. I love it here. And I've noticed that our code base is pretty big because it is actually a big project. As you start developing a certain features independently, this is actually like a sort of productivity hack for Android developers. You can actually change your main or your launcher activity. So if you're working on a feature, instead of working on the feature, launching it on the device, and then actually going through your navigation system. For example, if you have like a login screen or something, or in order to get to the feature that you're working on, you have to pass through more than two or three screens. What you can do is basically just change temporarily your launcher activity, and you can just launch directly into the activity, build your feature, and as you're done, you can roll back to your welcome or your home or your main activity. I found that pretty useful. So that's my second tip.
So the last tip that I have builds on exactly what you were saying, Kaushik, because that's exactly what I do, is I'll either change the Android manifest to launch the activity that I need, or if I need to change a file to load a particular fragment before 10 other fragments, then I'll put that in a particular file. The one problem that I've noticed that I've run into is sometimes I'll forget that I've changed that file and I'll commit it to source code, and all of a sudden, you know, the app is launching the wrong screen and tests are failing and all kinds of junk's happen. So one thing that I actually got from a friend of mine called Josh is he showed me a little Git trick that I didn't know about, and it's called assume unchanged. It's basically a command where you are able in Git, if you're using the Git source control, to tell it, hey, ignore this file. Any changes to the file, just go ahead and assume that it's unchanged. And so I can make changes to my manifest or whatever else, and Git will not recognize the changes. Now, that's good for when I'm doing this development. The only thing is you just need to make sure that you undo that, which there's another command to, you know, assume that the things are changed, but it makes it nice. So if you're consistently and you're performing a lot of commits in this like long development cycle for a feature, you don't have to worry about that one file that you probably aren't going to work with being committed to source control, which is really nice. We'll provide a link to the show notes to that for the Stack Overflow post where we found that.
All right. So it is time to wind this episode down. If you have questions, feedback, or anything for us, then please feel free to reach out to us on Twitter. Fragmented Cast is our Twitter handle. If people want to reach you, Hadi, what's the best way they can do that?
Yeah, so my on Twitter is just H Hariri, and if they want to email me, just they can. It's my easiest, fastest is Hadi@jetbrains.com. So anytime, or I also hang out quite a bit on the Kotlin Slack channel. So that's kotlinlang.slack.com. And I think that's on our website as well. They can see how to sign up to the Kotlin Slack channel there. So yeah, I'm pretty reachable.
Perfect. You can find the show notes for this episode at fragmentedpodcast.com/episodes/20. As I mentioned, if you have feedback or suggestions for us, please, we are always ears. Keep sending them in. We really do appreciate all the feedback we're getting in. If you want to reach Don, what is the best way we can do that?
Best way to reach me is going to be on Twitter. That's Don Felker. That's with two N's. Or you can reach me through my contact at donfelker.com.
Perfect. And I am Kaushik Gopal on Twitter. And my website is kausch.co. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next week.